Hello and welcome to another episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives. My name is Diana Isaacs, and I am joined with my co-host, Natalie Bellini. And in this episode, we wanted to actually address type 1 diabetes cures. So there's been a lot of talk recently on social media about this topic. And there were some great sessions at ADA, as well as actually at ACE annual meeting on this topic. And specifically, we wanted to talk about Eledon, who presented some fascinating results where 12 people are actually insulin free, and some of them up to 2 years out. So what is this amazing cure for type 1 diabetes? Well, it is actually islet cell transplant. So these islets are transplanted and they are able to make insulin. Now, what is unique about this study, perhaps compared to other studies that also have transplanted islet cells, is the immunosuppression used. So when you do put something like islet cells or any foreign thing into someone's body, right, you need immunosuppression. Otherwise, the body is going to reject it. And especially in type 1 diabetes, where often, right, the body's already been rejecting its own beta cells. So historically, they've used harsher drugs like tacrolimus, calciurin inhibitors, which can just have a lot of toxicities, especially on the kidneys. And so there's been a lot of interest to use drugs that are not so toxic. And so in this study, which was done at the University of Chicago, they actually used a new agent called tegoprubart. And this is actually an anti-CD4 ligand. And it's designed to not have all of the toxicities that we see with these other immunosuppressive agents. So currently in this study, the patients have been receiving this every 3 weeks. It is an IV. It's given IV. However, there's a lot of interest in, or hopefully it will come in other formulations in the future that are a little bit easier to take, maybe sub-Q, maybe potentially an oral formulation. But this is pretty remarkable. And when I say they're insulin free with normal A1Cs, like in the fives. And some of the people in the actual trial have actually been speaking out. We've heard them on social media saying like they're eating the things they want to eat. Like,
right. They're not on low carb diets. They're not doing some of the other things that people will do to try to have euglycemia. These people have euglycemia, period. And that to me is a big part of what's happening. Yeah, absolutely.
Right. So it's really, really fascinating. And so they're continuing, they actually got funding to continue to follow them out. So they're going to follow them out to 3 years. And, our hope is that they can stay insulin free, because that would be the closest thing, right, to a cure. So Natalie, curious your thoughts on this.
So it's 12 people, right?
Yes.
the benefit of that is it's 12 out of 12, right? Mm-hmm. It's not 8 out of 12. It's not 11 out of 12. It's all 12 people. So that's very exciting, right? Tacrolimus it has a very narrow therapeutic window. And so people who get kidney transplants and liver, we see people on it all the time in our clinical practice, right? But they struggle with the side effect profiles of it. So this is a huge, huge, huge benefit in the right direction. We need cadaver cells. And as we all know, the definition, we're working on changing to using pancreatic cells. They're not actually considered organs. And so part of our challenge is if we can get people to donate pancreatic cells and their organ donation, like when they become organ donors, that will help as well. There's big hurdles to still come. The thing about it is, remember the Edmonton protocol where it was like, okay, we're all closing our shop. Everyone's going to get follow the Edmonton protocol. We haven't talked about Edmonton because it didn't work as well as we thought, right? They never got 12 out of 12, right? They just didn't. So this is extremely hopeful data. My challenge with it is it's going to be a while. And how many times do you go for these 3 week infusions? Is that going to be 3 weeks forever? Can we start spreading it to 4 weeks or 5 weeks? Because if I needed an infusion once a quarter, even if I had to start it every 3 weeks for the rest of my life, but I never took insulin again and didn't end up with the glucose toxicity of the highs and the lows and the cardiovascular damage, I'm sticking out my arm, right? So I think what this is extremely hopeful. I think that the people that got the transplants had a lot of hypoglycemia. That's part of how they were recruited for this. So they had to have a history of severe hypoglycemia as part of this protocol. And so these people were truly suffering. These people were having things like crash your car lows, 911 calls, needing glucagon, those kinds of things. And so their lives have been completely changed by this. And I'm excited for them and I'm thrilled for them. We need to take this with a big, deep breath. I'm thrilled that it's 2 years out even. And then say, how do we again scale this and get it to other people, to get it to other centers to do the same trial, right? It's all by being done by one person right now. Those are kind of my top things of islet cells, long term, can you really go every 3 weeks for the rest of your life? Although for some of these people, if they live close and it's an easy access, why not, right? Cost will be another thing, because this is a trial, it's all free. So there's a lot of ifs and whens, but this is some of the best data we've had in my type 1 diabetes lifetime, which is more than 50 years now.
Right. Yeah. I mean, those are great points. And yeah, Breakthrough T1D is funding it right now, which fortunately, they're funding it. They fund a lot of this really great research
Yes, absolutely.
yeah. And yeah, I mean, in terms of some of the, I guess, digging a little bit deeper even into some of the results. So two of the people actually had to get two islet cell transplants. So just meaning the first one, they weren't having enough. They were still had elevated A1C. They needed some supplemental insulin. So they did need it again. But then when they had it a second time, then it kind of it took and it was okay. The other interesting thing was the people that needed the second often had higher BMIs, like BMIs of around 29. And then he also said when he presented the results at ADA, two of the people are actually on Mounjaro now. So it sounds like some characteristics of type 2 diabetes, which we see, right? There's overlap, especially in someone maybe with a higher BMI can have insulin resistance. And so two of the people are on tirzepatide, but doing very well, but they are on tirzepatide in addition to having that transplant. So it's very
I wonder if
interesting.
that is about weight, or is that about needing glucose, wanting additional glucose benefit, right? I would love to dive into that. We're not going to know, obviously, but that's another thing. I mean, we are using GLP-1s with people with type 1 all the time, and it for both, right? For both the cardiovascular and kidney risk reduction, as well as for to address some of the BMI. Or to help with it at least, right? Because BMI in and of itself, if you have a larger body habitus, it increases your risk of heart attacks and strokes all by itself, regardless of diabetes. Then you add diabetes to it. So that's an interesting thing to think that you need more beta cells or bigger, a more mass to feed a larger body mass person. So I'm not surprised that people with larger body mass may need a second or even more cells at the first time. This is really, I mean, some of this is clinically and scientifically really interesting, right? So that's, I wonder if they're going to change what they do. I mean, or their thought is, hey, we should go back and say people with a BMI greater than whatever it's going to be, 29, 30, whatever their number, their cutoff would be, get more cells from the start, right?
Right.
What a great,
Yeah.
not surprising, but yeah.
Yeah. And then to your point about the cells, right? So, like right now, a lot of it is coming from cadaver. There's a lot of interest in can we use stem cells? Can we manufacture these islets and on a much larger scale? Because ultimately, if this was going to be a cure for the masses, we would need to get a much larger amount of these islet cells. Some other approaches. So in the talk, this is going back now to the ACE meeting, but Aaron Kowalski gave a
Oh.
really, really nice talk on kind of where we are with type 1 diabetes cures. And so some of the things, you know, some of the strategies, as he said, he'd been trying to like encapsulate these islet cells to protect them, and that way maybe not even needing immunosuppression. But one of the things he highlighted is that these islet cells work much better when they have like blood flow, and they have like it seems that we're learning that the encapsulation has limitations. And so that's been an approach that's been tried, but may not be kind of the ultimate approach in terms of like, you know, bringing this to the masses and kind of having long-term success with not needing insulin, right? Because we don't want just like a year. We want to have
forever. Right. So just for those of you that don't know, Aaron Kowalski is the CEO of Breakthrough Type 1, formerly known as JDRF. And he actually is a PhD researcher, brilliant man, right? Who also happens to have type 1 diabetes. His heart is in the right place. You guys, I'm a huge fangirl, right? Like he's that kind of researcher to me, right? There's a handful of people out there that I'm just like, okay, I will sit and listen to him talk forever because of that, because of his tie, because of his interest. He has really done a huge amount of work to help Breakthrough get to where they are right now. Truly.
Yeah. He absolutely has. Yeah, we were very fortunate to have him at ACE because his talk was, you know, it was just so good in terms of like highlighting where we've been and where we are and everything. And then the other thing, you know, that he talked about was like gene editing. Like if there is a way to do some gene editing with these islets to where, you know, they would work, we would also wouldn't need immunosuppression. So there's definitely different strategies. And I think the other thing is there was also a talk at ABA given by Laura Jacobson on kind of like where we are with type 1 diabetes. And I think, you know, the thing to know is like we have all of these things in the pipeline. Obviously, you know, research is being done in this area. We also have therapies like teplizumab now to delay the progression at least stage 2 to stage 3 or new onset stage 3 to preserve beta cells. And I think the big thing is we want people to know about these things so that they can make an informed choice if they want, you know, all of this involves extra, you know, are you going to go to a research study? Are you going to take this drug for the rest of your life? Are you going to handle the side effects of, but right, we want people to know the options so that they can make an informed choice and we're not making it for them. And one of the things she especially highlighted is, you know, it's easy to say is like a healthcare professional, well, the tech is so good. Like we have CGM and AID, like people are doing fine. Do they need it? But we shouldn't be making that choice for a person. Like it's still really hard. And I think Aaron Kowalski highlights that really well. Like despite the greatest technology that we have, we're still giving insulin sub-Q, and that's not the physiologic way to give insulin. And so there's always going to be some highs or some lows. And this whole notion of an artificial pancreas is just really false because when you give sub-Q insulin, it's not an artificial pancreas. It's just not, right?
Right. So for those of you who don't know, Laura Jacobson is actually a peds endo out of the University of Florida. She's a researcher there. Phenomenal. She's an assistant professor of medicine, phenomenal lecturer. If you ever see her name anywhere and you're at a conference, go listen, right? She's that kind of good, right? And we don't say that about everyone.
We don't.
We're not even close to everyone, right? But I mean, you know, just because you're a researcher doesn't mean you can give a great presentation. Just because you're a clinician in clinical practice doesn't mean you can give a great presentation. We were looking for the combination. She's it. Aaron Kowalski's it. We've had a really good diabetes lecture year so far, right? Like that's the truth. So anyway, I think you're right. I mean, the challenge is that we can give everyone all the technology that they could have, you know, and that doesn't always improve outcomes. It can reduce risk sometimes. I mean, the data with A1Cs coming down using A1C, the data adding a GLP-1, the data is, you know, group data. I'm still having people in their early 20s ending up with complications. So yeah. The genetics of the complication side is what we're, you know, you can't always pick the person who will get them or her won't get them. And that's really the challenge, right? You know, we all know as clinicians, people with A1Cs of 14, you know, for years and years, typically develop complications. People though with A1Cs of 7, 7.5 also sometimes develop complications. And is it the fluctuations? Is it the swings? Is it the genetics? And when someone says to me, My father died young of a heart attack. My mother had a stroke at 60. My brother also has diabetes and he has kidney disease. And my brain, my whole body just shuts down because I know they have a bad gene pool for diabetes complications, right? So it's not just, you know, my time in range is 90%. That's a lot of it, right? Increase that time in range, reduce those lows, right? Reduce the DKA. But we still see people with what we call at goal time in range, at goal A1C, who develop complications over time. And that's the tragedy of this disease, right? And the burden of, you know, we write prescriptions. We have an option in our EHR to write for something we call food for life, which gets someone a prescription for fruit and vegetables. But access to it on a monthly basis, every year you can rewrite it for them, right? And you just have to say they have food insecurity. You don't even have to define it. There's no income limit. You as a clinician can just do it. The fact that I have to do that for people with diabetes, which is a cardiovascular disease, and they don't have access to fruit and vegetables, tells you why some of this is happening. Some of it is access to the rest of it, right? Access to, you know, just nutrition, right? Access to, but also access to all the clinicians you have to see. You need a dilated eye exam. You might need a kidney doctor or a cardiologist or this or that. And people, it's hard to get to it all. It's hard to schedule it all. It's hard to manage it all. So there is a sense that these treatments, these cures, aren't just for the people that can walk into your office with time and range of 82% with almost no lows, that are exercising and they have time and they can, you know, those kinds of things. It's for the rest of the people, which is the majority of what I see, right? The people that struggle day to day, that have high deductible plans, that don't have access all the time, or get, you know, like one of my very good friends in New Jersey was struggling for a while. I'm like, let me get you to the right people at the right. It's not state specific. It's not city specific. It's human beings. And that's where our challenges are.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And these trials have really been limited to people with meeting very strict criteria, like often elevated A1Cs along with all these severe hypoglycemic episodes, which is not, fortunately, not your average person with type 1 diabetes. And that's something Aaron Kowalski is really calling for, that they broaden the criteria to make these more accessible to more people with type 1 diabetes. And hopefully we'll see that as they discover how to do this on a larger scale. There's additional research funding to include more people. They did say they're going to be starting a trial with two sites, I think University of Chicago and Florida, in doing, you know, the islet cell transplant in people with reduced kidney function, because historically that was a population they really used caution in because of how harsh tacrolimus is. And so they're going to be including those people. So that's exciting.
Exciting, right? Like that's a big step. And can we preserve that little bit of kidney function they have left and make it that they never need dialysis? Wow. Right. This is, yeah. I mean, you're right.
We actually need a kidney transplant, because that's the other population where we would do transplants, is if somebody already needed a transplant, because then, you know, it makes sense. Right. They're going to need to take immunosuppression anyway. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's exciting. I don't know that the cure is 5 years away, but I know that it is. We're making nice progress in this area. So it's definitely super exciting.
And again, every time we talk about things like this, what do we say at the end? More to come.
More to come. Yes, always more to come. So, yeah. So thanks for tuning in. That wraps up this episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives.
Thanks, everyone.